Hey, so we're talking with Max Chaykin. Do I pronounce that correctly?
That's right, Chaykin.
Okay. Max got a lot of attention about 18 months ago because his undergraduate thesis at Brown University was called The Other Green Economy, and it is all about how much could be made by, in a legalized world, how much could be made by taxing marijuana. What inspired you to pick that subject for your thesis?
You know, I found it to be an interesting topic. A good friend of mine and former fraternity brother of mine was involved with the Rhode Island Patient Advocacy Coalition, which is the Rhode Island medical marijuana lobbying group who's done really great work in Rhode Island securing rights for patients. And so I was talking with him and thinking about writing a thesis, and the idea, you know, the question popped into my head, and I said, how much revenue could it be? I don't know. So I started to do some reading, and eventually that became the topic.
A certain amount of passion comes through in your thesis. Is that a fair statement?
Sure. You know, I certainly am an advocate for a more rational marijuana policy and drug policy in our country. I think that this argument about the economic side of it is certainly not a trivial argument, especially given the current state of our economy. So I certainly something that I grew to be pretty passionate about.
Now, while you were writing it, were you hoping you would get some media attention? Did you intend that to happen, or is that just a total surprise for you?
Well, as I was writing it, it became more and more real that the topic started gaining more and more traction in the media. I felt as I was throughout my entire, you know, research process. So it became more of a possibility, but I, you know, don't really know that I've gotten all that much, you know, attention for it, but it's certainly, my estimates were certainly much higher than what's currently out there. To whatever extent that could have generated buzz, I'm glad it did, I guess.
I believe the New York Times picked up on it.
It was mentioned briefly by the Freakonomics blog of the New York Times, yeah.
Got it. Now, when that story came out, did you have to fight off a bunch of economics groupies?
No, not really. But, it was certainly flattering that it was even linked to at all, and, you know, very well-respected blog, so it was, you know, humbling.
What grade did you get on your thesis?
Well, you don't really get a grade on a thesis. You know, I received honors from the department for my work, it was certainly a learning process for me. You know, the first time you undertake a serious, you know, graduate level or at least upper undergraduate level research, you know. It was a challenging process for me as well.
Okay. Well, a lot of people might not have read your thesis, so let me just quote a little bit of it with the main figure so people know that we're talking about.
Okay.
Okay. Here's what you said. If federal policymakers legally taxed and regulated marijuana with an excise tax of $4 per gram, I predict that this would generate at least $72 billion annually under the most minimal of circumstances. Under my best guess estimate, this tax would generate approximately $211 billion, and under the most optimistic assumptions, could generate over $300 billion annually in excise tax revenue. Now, you were just talking about excise or sin taxes. Are there other taxes that could also come in for marijuana besides excise taxes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you make this market, which is now in some parts of the country gray and some parts of the country still more of a black market, but if you make this entire market on the national level legal, you know, then you have to factor in payroll taxes and, mm-hmm. you know, Social Security, all these, you know, a whole host of other taxes, income taxes that people who are in the market might pay more of if they're not already paying some kind of taxes, and so on. But an excise tax is sort of a common tax for goods like alcohol and tobacco that are thought of by many to be harmful to society and have proven some proven cost to society of their use.
Do you feel that marijuana use is greater, less, or about the same as alcohol and tobacco?
Well, it's funny because a lot of the research indicates that it's less addictive drug. It is a less habit-forming and dependent drug for those who use it frequently than is nicotine or alcohol or opiates. And certainly we've, you know, especially over the past 15-ish, 20 years, the medical benefits of marijuana to patients with severe illnesses are extremely, you know, important.
But from a consumption standpoint, do you think there's more, less, or the same compared to, let's say, alcohol?
More or less or the same societal, you know, externalities, you mean?
How much is consumed or how much is spent? Let's put it that way.
How much is spent? Well,
compared to alcohol, I would say, and tobacco.
I'm sorry?
Do you think it's about the same or different than what people spend on alcohol and tobacco altogether?
It's hard to say. The
gut feeling.
My gut is that it's more. My gut is that it's more because currently in the black market, the price of marijuana is just inflated by its legal status in most places. Now that's in terms of the quantity used. There's much more tobacco grown for cigarettes, you know, in terms of pure quantity of the product than there is marijuana. Marijuana users don't use nearly as much as a pack a day of tobacco or two packs a day of, you know, cigarettes, you know. So in that sense, it's less. But in the sense of how much it's worth and how valuable it can be when it is been grown right and is of a high quality, it can be very valuable.
The image came to my mind of a pack of marijuana cigarettes, what that would look like.
I don't know what that would look like. I actually don't know that I think that's how it would necessarily be marketed or sold in a regulated legal market, but so certainly that's a funny image.
It might be if the tobacco industry gets in on it. They already have the cigarette making machines. I'm sure they could repurpose them.
Yeah, well, so it certainly could be. Okay. And you can certainly see a lot of products develop in alongside big industries, such as in the model of the tobacco industry, as part of what would be the new marijuana industry.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those maybe just a little later. Can we go back to we were talking about the sin taxes. Did you account for local or sales taxes in your estimates?
No, not really. Now, my estimates, the passage you read before from the conclusion, yes, basically said that if you follow everything that I've laid out up until this point, and if you, you know, agree with the various steps I've made along the way, then we wouldn't necessarily be surprised to see $200-300 billion in revenues from this industry. But I don't really think. I also wouldn't be surprised if it were closer to 100. But I still think we're more than what it is that Professors Getman and Myron, who their work is groundbreaking in the field, are currently thinking would be gained from legally taxing and regulating marijuana.
Did you have any contact with them while you were writing your thesis?
I had a little bit of contact with them while I was writing my thesis, but not terribly much. They were certainly courteous in the few exchanges we had, but we didn't. It wasn't very significant.
Okay. Well, I know that you're aware that they've had some criticisms of your work.
Yes.
Has that made you reconsider in the 18 months since you wrote your thesis, or has that made you feel stronger in your convictions?
Well, it's been about a year, I think, since I put the date that I placed on it.
Okay.
It's more like 18 months, but like you say, when you factor in when I started working on it. No, I think their criticism a lot. Some of their criticism is valid. You know, Professor Myron basically looks at the data out there and takes only the demand side data, while Professor Getman takes both demand and supply side data, and I take only the supply side data. And I lay out in detail why I chose that and why it seems to me that we should be looking at this data, you know, one data set and not another. But and I certainly I also think I expanded a little bit and tried to use other sources that aren't as traditional as well. But there's certainly some valid, you know, criticism that they have for my figures, and it does make me ultimately think, you know, maybe my more minimum estimates are in the better range rather than some of my more astonishing, you know, 200 to 300 billion estimates. But again, a lot of this comes from the fact that the data that we have to answer this question, how much revenue could there be, how much quantity is currently in the market, the data that we have to answer these questions is largely non-existent. I mean, there's so much guesswork that goes on in any of these papers, you know, that basically you have to at some point make assumptions that people could criticize. You have to decide which data you're going to use, which data you're not going to use, and try to justify that feeling. And I tried to do that in my paper, and clearly Professors Getman and Myron don't necessarily agree, and I respect that opinion. But I still have a feeling that we're talking about significantly more than their most recent estimates.
Will the availability of dispensary data be able to make future forecasts more accurate when it comes to seeking the maximum potential marijuana taxation revenue?
It might. And certainly being able to say that in Denver or in South, you know, in a certain location, we know at least this much is being sold at these prices in a month or in a whatever period of time, that definitely can give you a sense of something. I mean, of like I said, what's being sold in Denver in that given month. So how much that data can be extrapolated, you know, depends what you find. If you had data like that from every dispensary in California, that'd be something to really work with and see, well, okay, how much is being sold? What do we think how do we think that differs from an illegal market? And so on. You know, in my paper, I basically created a hypothetical framework under which marijuana was made legal in the country, federally, as of, let's say, tomorrow. Now, clearly, there's going to be short-term and long-term effects. And so the fact that we have this slowly evolving state by state in our federalist structure with marijuana laws and medical marijuana laws and decriminalization policies. So it's not as black and white as the situation that I tried to lay out to estimate. But
well, we like that. We like visualizing what complete landscape, what complete legalization looks like.
Sure. Yeah. It's certainly not as far off as it was a couple years ago, even.
Let me mention some things that could occur under complete legalization, and you can tell me what you think they might be worth. What if Big Food got into the act and started coming up with a bunch of edibles and drinks? What kind of taxation could be gleaned from that?
Well, it's hard to say. How would those, you know?
Like, I'm talking about the General Mills of the world. It's like a land rush. We're legal. You're General Mills. What happens?
Certainly, they get involved potentially in trying to develop products of that nature. Whether or not those products would ultimately increase revenue matters of whether they'd increase demand for THC, for cannabis products of all sorts. It's certainly likely that those products might only substitute from people who are currently buying marijuana you know, at medical dispensaries, and instead they now buy the new General Mills product. So it might not create that much more tax revenue than we're thinking about when we think about the whole market as it is now.
Because it's a sideways movement is what that could happen. It could happen, or it could create the market.
Or it could create demand, right. It could additionally shift demand. And that's ultimately one of the biggest questions we have in this research is, what is demand? How many people in our country are using marijuana? How much are they using? How frequently are they using it? How do they respond to changes in price and changes in quality and changes and all these different things that we know will happen in a legal landscape?
So demand is all about consumption. Is that a fair statement?
Demand is consumption. How much are people going to use of the good?
And from what our listeners, when you're talking about marijuana, when you're talking about supply, right now you're mostly talking about seizure statistics. Could you explain that for people?
Sure. So basically I try to estimate a simple equation of my variable of interest is revenue. We want to know how much the federal government as a central entity could potentially earn if the marijuana market that we have today were legal and regulated and taxed. So there's a few different ways to go about this. You have to try to know something about price. You have to know something about what the price of marijuana currently is in the market. We know that it varies regionally. We know that it varies by quality. It's not necessarily easy to know much about price, but we have some limited data on price to give us a general range of, you know, what's out there. And then you need to know something about the quantity of how much is being consumed. So there's two ways to know how much quantity is being consumed. Producers supply marijuana to the market. They grow it. There's a whole illicit chain of distribution that we know very little about, except for what the DEA and the ONDCP kind of tell us about it. And so on supply side data, we have information about what the government has claimed to seize in terms of pure pounds and really metric tons of marijuana. We have information about how many plants have been eradicated in outdoor and indoor locations. We have some information, and then we have some information about where we suspect this marijuana that's being seized, mostly at the southwest borders, is coming from, also some of the northern border as well. So that's on the supply side. You have all that data, and to get an estimate of how much is out there, you have to say, okay, well, how good are they at catching it? You know, are they getting 10% of the market that's in the country, or are they getting 2%? I mean, or are we being generous? Are they getting a quarter of it, a solid third of it, of what's out there? So
would it be fair to say you're more suspicious of their statistics than John Getman?
I think so. I mean, you know, those sources that tell us that try to estimate how much is cultivated domestically, for example, will say that the eradication efforts are getting 30 to 50% of the domestically grown market. I just think that's pretty unrealistic. You know, I don't think that one in two plants grown in this country, either indoors or outdoors, is being seized or eradicated by the government.
30% sounds a little high. I think you've gotten some criticism because you went down as low as 2 or 3%. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right. So for the sake of understanding what the very maximum could be, you know, it's helpful. It was helpful for me at least to say, okay, well, what if they're only getting 2%? You know, what if the metric tons that we know the government has seized is only 2% of the market that's out there? Then there's a ridiculous – that's probably unlikely, only because some of the data on the demand side now that I did exclude indicates that it should be – that perhaps their numbers such as 10, 20% are more realistic based on what we think we might know about how many people are smoking or are using marijuana.
Okay.
So on the demand side – one of the criticisms that was of my paper was that I excluded demand-side data. So that what that means is that I didn't use the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, the NSDUH data, that Professor Getman used, that basically says we think there are so-and-so million Americans who use marijuana and they use approximately so-and-so much. Basically, we know that those surveys underestimate significantly how many users there are. And the most recent data we even have about frequency of use, about how many times those users are using, is 15 years old. So a lot of that data, to me, in my assessment of it, was more suspect than the amount of data seized that the government is saying, we seized this much marijuana, a hard quantity we know came into the country, we took it away, we took it off the market. And so that, I think, was one of the criticisms as well, that I did exclude some data that would have resulted in estimates closer to Professor Getman's.
Why is it so valuable to know the average weight of a joint?
It's valuable if you're using demand-based...
It's only demand-side data. Okay. So for your paper, it wasn't factored, correct?
No, not a factor I used. If a joint is 0.75 grams or 0.5 grams or a gram, will make a big difference in terms of, as Professor Getman, I believe he said, it'll make a big difference in terms of how many doses in court you're being charged with providing to the market in some states, or could make a big difference in terms of trying to understand how much quantity is being consumed by the 25 millions of users or 40 million users, whatever it is. But if you've excluded that data because you don't think we it gives you enough, basically it's a really hard, it's another one of many assumptions to make with that data, that I basically chose not to make.
Okay. Now, Max, I'm glad you mentioned chain of supply earlier. One of the problems I see with the current data that gets analyzed, everyone's very obsessed with the weight of a joint. They're very obsessed with seizure statistics, but they seem to act like every transaction is just a few joints or maybe an ounce, when there's all these layers of middlemen. There's a whole wholesaling that doesn't seem to be accounted for in any of these in either the demand side or the supply side data. And I think that could be extremely lucrative, because I believe several people make money, not just the grower and the end consumer.
Right. So there are definitely a whole chain of supply between whoever is planting the seeds and watering them and doing whatever they're doing with with technology, which is really quite amazing, some of the things that you can do to enhance strains and create a better product, a better quality product, which should fetch a higher price. But between that guy, whoever's doing that, and the end user, there are a couple steps that will become much more, perhaps not more lucrative, but we will know much more about them in a legal landscape, and so many more people will be factored into that market when you try to understand how big that market is, how much it generates as part of the economy, what size of, how much it contributes in tax dollars to state and local and federal purses.
Yeah, so your minimal figure of approximately $70 billion, that's a starting point when we start to add on other factors like the wholesale transactions, the income taxes those people would pay.
I think so. I mean, I think it's hard to know exactly because, again, when I created this circumstance, I basically extracted from assuming that I don't know anything about whether there will be licenses for producers or for retail distributors, or if every person who wants to purchase marijuana or cannabis products has to have some sort of user registration. There could be a ton of fees and regulations that we could imagine that still might bring the price down from what it currently is and allow marijuana to be purchased legally, or cannabis products generally to be purchased legally. And so, I'm sorry, I lost the train of thought.
I think you were talking about, I believe, with the economic term is elasticity?
No, I'm sorry. I think I was talking about regulations, actually. So the
you're talking about how the prices would change with different regulations.
Right. So you, as under different regulatory regimes, you can imagine that the cost to consumers and to producers are going to change, you know, but ultimately in a legal landscape, we expect price to fall. And we expect there to be a price somewhere between that completely free market, you know, price, like as if it were traded like rice, for example, which would be purely the cost of what it costs to grow such and such a strain of marijuana, and a price and between the current price that will include the cost of regulations and the cost of taxes and still ensure that we have compliance with a legal with a legal market, and that the government at various levels is going to be earning revenue from the sale of this good.
How much would the price of, let's say, an ounce compress from its present average of approximately $400, do you think? You can just go with gut feelings. I know there's no obvious...
Right, yeah. Statistic. So there's no obvious answer to that. I think even with tax, you might see that same $400 ounce for $150, $50 of which could be taxed, maybe even $75. But it also depends, again, on quality and on... You know, we know, for example, with wine and with beer, mm-hmm. that consumers will pay a high premium for better brands, higher quality, higher alcohol content beers, for example, do much better and fetch a much higher price than do your Budweiser or your Coors Light. The same thing will happen, and I think even more so, in a legally regulated marijuana market. You're finding strains out in California that might be up to $75 a gram because they're so strong. So when you, like you said, if the average price of an ounce is $400, you could see that there might be ounces out there that are going for $550, and those might fall even further because they, you know, or they might not fall as much, and you're going to still see a far, pretty serious range of prices based on quality, based on how close you are to the. To the production, to the, you know, initial step in the production ladder.
Do you think we'll see collectability in marijuana the same way we see it in wine right now? If storage was invented that could preserve it for long periods of time,
That you know that you'd see some sort of you know strain that from this year in this place that did you know that was preserved and. Cost $1,000 per gram in 5 years? I don't think so. But it certainly isn't that far-fetched, right? I mean, if you have real, you know, you could see that unique growers or people who invent the most creative ways of growing this indoors with the right lights and with the right this and that, and it's a very complicated process for people who are investing time and money into it, which producers would do more willingly if there weren't as much risk of losing that when they can't get their product to market in time. So certainly it's a possibility. I don't know how much it would generate, or I can't really speculate too much about that, but I okay. don't see it as terribly far-fetched.
Was there a lab portion of your thesis where you had to grow some?
No, certain not nothing like that.
It's not like chemistry, economics, where you have a lab portion. Okay, Max, let me ask you this. Coincidentally, in the year or 18 months since you started or undertook your thesis, there's been an unbelievable avalanche of free publicity for the whole cannabis commerce scene. What monetary effect would you give that, or wouldn't you? I mean, it's been unbelievable. It's blasted on every newspaper. It's on every radio. It's endless. If people were paying for this, it would be unbelievable.
Yeah.
What kind of percentage increase boost would you give this, or wouldn't you?
I wouldn't say that it gives an increase to the potential revenue. What I would say is that it does a lot to affect cultural attitudes, which affect demand. Okay, so in my paper, I kind of assume that demand won't shift in the long term, which means that basically, if people in the country right now that marijuana more a little more might be consumed if price falls, but that the overall demand of the population for the product won't change that much. Clearly, over time, that it can change. So what this recent, over the last year and a half, like you said, boost of publicity, what will really do, I think, is has the potential to get bring more people into the market who might not currently be using, whether that is legally as medicinal users in their respective states, or whether that's in illicit fashion and, you know, depending on the jurisdiction. But it has the potential to bring people into the market and has the potential to sort of slowly push demand out before we get to a complete legal, legal market or legally regulated market. So, and, if Americans are consuming a larger quantity of marijuana, then there will be a larger quantity of taxes that go into the government's purse strings.
Well, at the very least, it seems like it's removed the stigma of that marijuana is a drug, which would seem like it would encourage some people to enter the market. I'm not saying everyone would flock to it, but removing the stigma because everyone's doing it on TV, I think that is a big deal, and it could boost it relatively significantly, but don't know for sure.
Yeah. Right, well, it could certainly change demand, and however it would change the demand would ultimately change how much tax revenue is available from a regulated market.
Okay, well, let's talk about supply, which is your field of expertise. John Getman seems awful sure there's not too much more than 15,000 metric tons of marijuana produced in the United States. And for people who don't know, a metric ton is about 2,200 pounds. Your thesis got up as high as, I believe, 175,000 metric tons. How do we escalate from 15 to 175,000?
Well, from 15,000 to 175,000. Well, it hold on, I'm taking a look at this at the same thing. Basically, with when you change the parameters of the equation you're estimating, it can change fairly significantly. So some those parameters include a few different things. First and foremost, they includes what the number that was seized. In this case, how much marijuana was seized. So the numbers, we know that over the past few years it's been increasing, and we know that the amount seized has been increasing, the number of plants eradicated has been increasing, both indoors and outdoors, and we know that so that would imply that both foreign production, more is being imported and more is being grown domestically, and we know that with that increased production has also come an increase in quality. Mm. So all these things would lead us to believe that more marijuana is being consumed in the country as time goes on. And I believe if I recall, that 15,000 metric tons or so is Getman's average. And so that basically is based on certain proportion, you know, that it's about 10% that the government is seizing, that the crop, certain plant yields and certain, basically various parameters. When you relax those parameters a little bit to understand what the maximum potential could be, you start getting up into a much higher number of metric tons that could be on the market. But it is somewhat speculative. So,
what are you feeling today?
My feeling today?
April 2010.
My feeling is that there could be 15 to 20,000 metric tons easily on the market. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a little bit more. The 2010 national, interestingly, the 2010 National Drug Threat Assessment is out.
Okay.
And so that puts the figure for 2008 as to how much was produced in Mexico at 21,500 metric tons produced in Mexico.
Okay.
So even if only half of that's coming into the United States, that's 10,000 right there. That's, you know, 10,750 metric tons right there. And so if that's only, and we know there's a lot that's being grown in the country as well. So it's not inconceivable to me that we currently have about 20,000, maybe 25,000 metric tons on the domestic market, you know, that's being consumed by Americans.
In under legalization, could we be putting import taxes on the marijuana grown in Mexico and Canada?
Under legalization, it's not exactly the international side of things in terms of international trade is actually kind of complicated, because what you might see is if the United States decided to suddenly, okay, marijuana is completely legal now, you might see a trickle-down effect where tons of countries who could become serious marijuana exporters start to do so and start to take it to produce marijuana who aren't necessarily doing it now, or maybe doing it now, but then can more easily export it and sell it in various markets. So
the precedent is liquor.
Right. So I think that you would. I think that imports. I have a feeling that in a legally regulated market, the more technologically advanced methods of growing that can happen indoors and outdoors are going to be favored, which would tend to favor an economy that has more capital, like a first world economy like ours, as opposed to, Thailand or something or another country that exports a lot of agricultural goods, more so than we do. But that's the feeling, and I don't know how much. It's hard to say.
Would the export side of things be any different, or is there also the possibility for export taxes that could be significant?
Absolutely, there's a possibility that we could be exporting choice strains and importing choice strains of different. It's a wide world of unknown.
Right.
Where could it go? How much could we? Get at the border for imported, product, and how much, would we get again then when it's sold at retail level? It's really, there's some potential there.
So there is a lot of upside. We're not talking about pie in the sky. We're not looking for something that doesn't exist. There is a real upside.
Well, there's a real upside, and I think what Professor Myron would say is that a lot of those things that are an upside aren't even necessarily an upside, but they're now being counted. And the way we count is really, it does make a big difference. If we all of a sudden are counting thousands and thousands of jobs that currently were considering those people either not part of the labor force or unemployed, and all of a sudden there's thousands of jobs, and as an industry that's starting to create jobs currently, let's say this happened tomorrow, marijuana is legally regulated, and we wake up and it's a totally different situation. There's a whole lot of jobs that we're counting automatically,
mm-hmm.
and the industry itself would be in a place where it's going to be eagerly looking to hire workers, to bring people in, to start expanding, to start settling itself on legal ground, that it's, depending how you count, makes a big difference.
I believe Professor Myron might say, well, they're not really jobs that are created. There are jobs that go sideways from people who used to be working at Radio Shack. But does it also create jobs, or can you address that? Are we creating jobs, or are people just being repurposed into different jobs, or both?
I think a lot of it is being repurposed, but the fact that we can start counting it isn't insignificant. It means we can see that, less of the population than we thought is actually not gainfully employed. More people are supporting the Social Security tax base. More, politically, it matters how you count it. That's all I'm saying. I think Professor Myron is probably right. Some of those jobs will come from Radio Shack or from McDonald's or from other places that, but some of them will come from, some of it will be
an industry that is growing, that is that is you know, going to be investing in new grow houses, investing in new equipment, investing in you know, new products of all sorts.
And the other thing that we've noticed is that cannabis commerce, in addition to creating new opportunities, it stimulates existing businesses. Let's say security businesses, locksmiths, security camera people. It's landlords and commercial landlords. It's a big stimulation for existing businesses in the community. Like one dispensary owner said that he had hired 20 different people, from the carpet installer to the HVAC people. So it seems like it really creates there's a ripple effect of cannabis commerce. Do you see that?
Well, right, and it would be all newly able to be counted legally, right? So it's not – a lot of this commerce is not new, you know, people but people are participating in this market now. But that's not being done in a way that allows someone to say, oh, I want to buy a retail franchise of this glass store and employ more people to make glassware that are going to make it on their spare side and be more productive with their time. They're not even going to quit their day job. You know, they're going to add more productivity to the economy. And basically, I don't think it's trivial that you would really be counting it anew, even if it's not true job creation as much as a reassignment of jobs. I don't think it's trivial. I think there would be people put to work who might not otherwise be working right now and would be willing to work legally mm-hmm. as a grower, as a light technician. Who knows what it would be. But I think there is some potential at least for true job creation.
Yeah, and plus these people seem to really enjoy their jobs, which is a big thing to me. It's not just a job for the sake of a job number. Now, in Massachusetts, which is a medical marijuana state, you don't have dispensaries yet? Give us an idea what's going on. As you probably know from the little bit you've seen on our website, I just happened to coincidentally move into a giant hotbed. And I guess I had the impression that all those states that were medical marijuana states, they have dispensaries just like us. But that's not true, is it?
Not true, actually. On the East Coast, the medical marijuana laws are, generally, from what I know at least, they're more restrictive than they are in the West. For example, Rhode Island just this past June, just shortly after I published my work, that they passed their first dispensary. Massachusetts, to my knowledge, doesn't have any dispensaries. Then again, marijuana possession of up to an ounce is punishable by only a $100 fine in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So it's effectively a speeding ticket. Tisk tisk, you shouldn't do it. You know, cough up $100 and if you're caught, and that's, you know, so Massachusetts is one of the more liberal states on the East Coast, but New Jersey, even, for example, which just passed medical marijuana as well, is also, I think, a fairly strict statute from what I understand.
So that's something I think a lot of people here don't even realize. We thought we were just another marijuana hotbed. So there's a lot of resistance still to the fact that the dispensaries, because right now they're just right in regular neighborhoods. We'll start putting the pictures on our websites. It's just, here's the barber shop, here's the dispensary, here's the donut shop, you know. It's just become totally normal. It's amazing. Yeah. Especially in South Denver, because you're allowed signage. In Boulder, for example, the signage is very restrictive. Here it's this neon like marijuana lease everywhere you go.
No, yeah. So it varies a lot, obviously, state by state, and a lot of the East, you know, the California and Colorado are kind of a different world still in terms of policy and in terms of the de facto what's happening on the ground. From New Jersey and Rhode Island and Massachusetts and the East Coast states that have started that move.
Yeah, so there's a lot of licensing fees that are possible too, as I believe you mentioned in your report you said earlier in this conversation. And that's not trivial either.
No, it's not trivial. And I think even, you know, let's say that the state slapped a $5,000 licensing fee for a dispensary. Who knows?
That's what it is here.
Okay, one-time only fee. A lot of people would pay that fee and then still know that then there's still be profit for them, say serious profit for them in the market. There are lots of different regulatory options like that could generate revenue, and depending on how you construct it, it certainly could be very significant revenue.
Okay. Well, we have to wrap it up. So let me see if I can sum up where we are. You are very strong in your conviction that your minimal prediction is the least of the potential marijuana tax revenue there is. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is there...
I still feel pretty good about those minimal numbers. I don't feel nearly as confident about the $200-300 billion, but I wouldn't also be surprised. And it really depends on how you set the parameters on how big you think the market is now. That's ultimately what I think Professor Getman and Professor Myron and I fundamentally, I guess, disagree about is how big is the market now? I think Professor Getman trusts the National Survey of Drug Use and Health data enough to say that he tempers down his estimates based on the supply side data. Professor Myron, I think, only used that one report, if I recall, which counted an expenditure level. So I certainly don't necessarily think I disagree with his numbers. I think his methodology is really quite fine, but I think that when you go into more depth into the data, I chose not to use the demand side data to understand how much is on the market in terms of quantity. I saw use the supply side data, and that's basically the difference.
Do you concur with Myron that you don't believe that demand will change under legalization? Is that true?
That's the assumption I use in my report. I do kind of think that demand could change. I don't think that would be necessarily a bad thing. Increased consumption of a good is not necessarily a bad thing economically, except insofar as it could produce negative externalities on society. I mean, if the far right's worst fear comes true and everyone in the country doesn't go to work anymore because all they do is sit and watch TV and eat Fruit Loops, then that could produce a negative externality on the economy. I don't think that'll happen. I think for by and large, the people who want to use marijuana are using it now. I think that, like Professor Getman said, there is absolutely a price legally by which the government can make a serious amount of tax revenue that consumers will pay, that producers will still be making a serious profit, and I think we should be moving in that direction.
If you can put yourself into the boots of a grower for a moment, where do you suspect their resistance would be to a sin tax? Do you think it would be under or over 50%? Just think about it now. You've nursed these plants through like 4 months. You're out there every day, hail, insects, da-da-da-da-da. Someone comes up to you and says, oh, well, tobacco's taxed at 60%, so you don't mind giving me 60% of your profits, do you?
Well, actually, I don't think that's how it would work. What I laid out in my work is the idea that supply would be perfectly elastic in the long run. And what that means is if supply is elastic, it means that there's such a glut of supply in this market that producers basically just charge their marginal cost, that producers basically push the entire incidence of the tax onto the consumer. So I basically think that in a legally regulated market, supply is going to be elastic enough that producers are going to set their price based on how much it costs them to produce the products that they're producing, and the tax will be on top of that for what basically just the additional amount that the consumer will pay to purchase the product.
Your $4 a gram, does that translate to a percentage or not necessarily?
Depends what you think the price of marijuana will be.
Okay, gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
So my gut says $4 a gram is about – it could be a solid starting place for what a government, be it a state government or the federal government, if they wanted to tomorrow say what should the tax be? My answer would be $4 a gram. Let's see where that goes. Let's see how that starts us off. And recognizing that taxes change over time. Taxes could go lower, could go higher, could go to an ad valorem or a percentage-based tax, depending on how good enforcement's been and how much revenue is being created, there are options after that.
Yeah, I like the $4 a gram for medical marijuana, which averages about 16 to 18. I think around 20, 25%, I think that's That's my gut feeling, that growers that put their lifeblood into this would pay. I have a lot of doubt that they would go up to 50%. But anyhow, well, Max, thank you so much for being with us. It was really illuminating.
Thank you.
You were great, and we appreciate you ramping up to talk to us. Are you doing anything else with in the marijuana world now, or you sort of off it right now? Is there any? Will you return? Will you write another paper?
Well, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. I'm not in school right now. I do hope to go to law school at some point in the near future. I think I'll be applying in the fall. And you know, as a lawyer, I think drug policy is a really important issue. I think it affects a lot of different parts of society. I think that there are arguments to be made for legally taxing and regulating marijuana that have nothing to do with the revenue, as much as the revenue, I think, is also important. So I think it'll be an issue that I feel passionate about for time to come, and we'll see where life takes me.
All right. Thank you so much, Max.
Take care.